In this view, the ordinary life, devoted to production, serving the customer, and supporting a family, is a noble and dignified endeavor. Hard work, once considered a curse, now becomes socially acceptable, even honorable. Commerce, formerly a degraded thing, now becomes a virtue. Of course, the founders recognized that both in the private and the public sphere, greedy and ambitious people might pose a danger to the well-being of others. Instead of trying to outlaw these passions, the founders attempted a different approach. As the 51st book of the Federalist Papers puts it, "Ambition must be made to counteract ambition." The argument is that in a free society, the security for civil rights must be the same as that for religious rights. It consists in the one case in the multiplicity of interests, in the other in the multiplicity of sects. The framers of the Constitution reasoned that by setting interests against each other, by making them compete, no single one could become strong enough to imperil the welfare of the whole. In the public sphere, the founders took special care to devise a system that would prevent, or at least minimize, the abuse of power. To this end, they established limited government in order that the power of the state would remain confined. They divided authority between the national and state governments. Within the national framework, they provided for separation of powers, so that the legislature, executive, and judiciary would each have its own domain of power. They insisted upon checks and balances to enhance accountability. In general, the founders adopted a policy of supplying by opposite and rival interests the defect of better motives. This is not to say that the founders ignored the importance of virtue, but they knew that virtue is not always in abundant supply. The Greek philosophers held that virtue was the same thing as knowledge, that people do bad things because they are ignorant. But the American founders did not agree. Their view was closer to that of St. Paul. "The good that I would, I do not. The evil that I would not, that I do." According to Christianity, the problem of the bad person is that his will is corrupted, and this is a fault endemic to human nature. The American founders knew they could not transform human nature, so they devised a system that would thwart the schemes of the wicked and channel the energies of flawed persons toward the public good. The experiment that the founders embarked upon 2 centuries ago has largely succeeded in achieving its goals. We see the evidence in New York, which presents an amazing sight to the world. Tribal and religious battles, such as we see in Lebanon, Mogadishu, Kashmir, and Belfast, don't happen here. In New York, restaurants, white and African-American secretaries have lunch together. In Silicon Alley, Americans of Jewish and Palestinian descent collaborate on e-commerce solutions and play racquetball after work. Hindus and Muslims, Serbs and Croats, Turks and Armenians, Irish Catholics and British Protestants all seem to have forgotten their ancestral differences and joined the vast and varied parade of New Yorkers. Everybody wants to make it, to get ahead, to hit it big. And even as they compete, people recognize that somehow they are all in this together in pursuit of some great, elusive American dream. In this respect, New York is a resplendent symbol of America. My conclusion is that the American founders solved 2 great problems, the problem of scarcity and the problem of diversity, that were a source of perennial misery and conflict in ancient societies, and that remain unsolved in the regimes of contemporary Islam. The founders invented a new regime in which citizens would enjoy a wide berth of freedom, economic freedom, political freedom, and freedom of speech and religion, in order to shape their own lives and pursue happiness. By separating religion from government, and by directing the energies of the citizens toward trade and commerce, the American founders created a rich, dynamic, and tolerant society that is now the hope of countless immigrants and a magnet for the world. Despite the fantastic scope and opportunity that America provides, many immigrants experience occasional ambivalence and anguish about their adopted country. My colleague Shelby Steele terms this the shock of freedom. I see it more as the anxiety of displacement. In any event, immigrants commonly report feelings of uncertainty, loss, loneliness, a sense of being adrift in unfamiliar waters. To some extent, these are the natural sentiments of one who is trying to find his way in a new society. What is new is that immigrants today encounter a multicultural ideology that encourages them to cling to their native ways, to resist assimilation, to affirm their differences. From the multicultural perspective, asking the immigrant to become an American is forcing him to give up who he is. In this view, assimilation is an expression of bigotry, because the non-white immigrant is required to put on a white cultural straitjacket. Multiculturalists say that white Americans should be the ones who adapt. They should learn to respect and cherish cultural differences. The multiculturalists regard the melting pot as a racist concept. In their view, immigrants should maintain their native identity and their traditional customs. The multiculturalists want immigrants to be in America, but not of America. But this does not seem to be what most immigrants want. The reason is simple. If the immigrant wanted to preserve intact his native culture, if he wanted to be the same person that he was in his home country, then why come to the United States? Clearly, the immigrant seeks something that is available here and not in his homeland. That's something I have suggested is the opportunity to have a good life, but more important, the chance to make his own life. Most immigrants realize that this requires adapting to the cultural strategies of success in the United States. There is nothing bigoted or racist about this. It does not mean that in order for me to become American, I have to quit playing the sitar or stop eating curry. I can preserve elements of my native culture and still wholeheartedly participate in the American way of life. This was not always the case with earlier generations of immigrants who were pressured to abandon their old lives and become completely new people. A century ago, one social worker in New York noted of a family that had recently arrived from Sicily, not yet Americanized, still eating Italian food. The nativist prejudice was that Italian Americans were somehow incomplete Americans. As Teddy Roosevelt put it with characteristic pugnacity, there is no room in this country for hyphenated Americans. But this is too harsh and makes unnecessary and unreasonable demands on immigrants. A much better idea is the melting pot, which emerged in resistance to the nativist. The melting pot concept is that immigrants bring something new and valuable to America, just as America has much that is new and valuable to offer them. So immigrants change America, and America changes the immigrants. Pizza and hamburgers, once alien imports from Italy and Germany, have become quintessentially American foods. Chinese food is now well established, and Indian and Thai dishes are also quite popular. While Americans benefit from this variety of cuisine, immigrants too realize that they have choices. In India, I ate curry and rice every day. Now I have the choice of eating southern fried chicken or enchiladas. Why then should I hold on to my native culture and limit myself to the options my ancestors had? I am using the example of cuisine to make the broader point that ethnicity in the old world is involuntary, but in America it is to a large degree chosen. Think about it this way. Mario Cuomo's grandfather had no choice but to be Italian. That was an identity that was imposed on him. It defined who he was, what he ate, what he believed. But with the grandson, it is a different story. No one is more Italian than Mario Cuomo. On Columbus Day, when he speaks before the Anti-Defamation League, however, he sings a different melody. I am quite sure Mario Cuomo likes pasta, but I doubt that it encompasses the whole of his cuisine. He has chosen what he wants to retain from the old world and what he wants to relinquish. As an American, his Italian heritage is only one part of Mario Cuomo's identity. I have been speaking of ethnicity largely in the cosmetic, superficial sense. At this surface level, it is possible for immigrants to live in several cultures. One doesn't have to choose between eating curry and eating southern fried chicken. One can do both. I can watch a Hindi film this week and Harrison Ford's latest thriller the next week. But at the deeper level, this is not possible. Cultures are fundamentally rooted in the cult, and they embody worldviews that are sometimes incompatible and irreconcilable.